This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
I'm Morgan.
And I'm Sarah.
And this week, we are on episode 73, where we are covering Richard Chase, a.k.a. the Sacramento Vampire.
And this is actually our first listener suggestion that we're covering, and it came to us in an email by a listener named Malachi, which is a great name.
Thanks, Malachi.
And a little bit about it is Richard Chase was a serial killer, rapist, cannibal, and necrophile. He became known as the Sacramento Vampire as he believed that he needed to drink his victim's blood in order to heal his many ailments. And we also want to warn you that this is most likely the most gruesome case that we have covered so far. It is very graphic. We will let you know when there are graphic parts coming up, but everything as a whole, this is a pretty gruesome case, and it involves heavy accounts of rape, mutilation, the murder of small children, and very violent accounts of animal abuse.
Yes, so if you are not interested in that, do not check this episode out, because it will be a gruesome one.
Yeah, it's going to be a doozy. Why don't I ask you what you're binging first?
Sure.
Switch it up.
I guess. I am binging The Queen's Gambit this week on Netflix, like nice. Everybody else is. It is really good. It's about chess. I don't want to go too much into it because I don't want to give away the plot line. But the main girl in it is the same girl from the movie The Witch, which is spelt with two V's on the cover, which Ooh. I like to call The Witch. And yeah, she's really cool. Anya Taylor-Joy, I think is her name. And I never thought I'd be that interested in chess, but it's super fun. So yeah, I would check it out.
I haven't started it yet because I was like, I don't think that's something I'd be too interested in, but I see so many people that are really into it.
It's like definitely a historical piece, mm-hmm. like not historical, but like, what are those? Period pieces is what I mean. It's like a period piece because it's set in like the 60s and 70s. But I really liked it because it's not just about chess, but mm-hmm. it's like she's basically like a savant, essentially, at chess. Like, she is an orphan who just, like, at the age of 9 realizes she can play chess and just, like, see a chessboard and, like, do the moves in her head type thing.
Okay, that's cool.
So it's just, like, her life, basically, from that. And it's really cool. I liked it.
Very cool. And I think I've also heard, like, it's based on a true story or something like that.
I meant to look that up, and I didn't. I know that it's based off of a book for sure.
Okay.
But I don't know if that book is based on true events or if it's a fiction. And I meant to look that up and just didn't. Oh. But you can look it up for yourselves if you want to, listeners. What are you binging this week, Sarah?
So I'm binging another hard seltzer, but this one I actually like.
Nice.
And I've been drinking like the Bud Light seltzers because honestly they're cheaper than White Claw, but I've gotten kind of tired of the flavors, and I didn't realize that they had a second variety pack. Mm. And it's not the Christmas one because I've heard the Christmas one is trash, mm-hmm. but this one has pineapple, grapefruit, strawberry, and cranberry, mm-hmm. and they're all like much more flavorful than the original ones I've found, and cranberry is my favorite one. It's like real tart, and they're just really good, and I like them more than the like original pack with the lime and stuff in it.
Nice.
But that's it. My simple binge. I found a seltzer that I like instead of that shitty Smirnoff one.
Very nice. I'm sure the people, because I think last week you claimed that you were a seltzer aficionado.
Oh, yeah.
Or something like that. You used a specific word, and I liked it. Listening back, I was like, what a specific term she used to talk about seltzer.
I've tried them all.
I don't think that's true, to be honest. That is, because there's so many seltzers out there.
I have tried Bud Light and Smirnoff and White Claw and Vizzy And
don't list all the ones.
There's only one more in Crooks and Marker.
Okay. I was like, this could literally go on forever.
No, I've only tried like five. Okay. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Sarah, you're like, you're the equivalent of an IPA boy now.
I am.
You looked so sad when I said that. You were like, I am. The crestfallen one.
I was very excited for a minute, and then I was like, no, I'm not.
I'm sorry. I did not mean to offend you.
That's okay. I mean, it's pretty basic.
Nah, but I mean, they do taste good, and they get you fucked up, so who the fuck cares?
Exactly. <know? laughs> Like, they have more alcohol in them than, like, some beers that I've drinking.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So, who cares? Here I'm not I drinking am. Fucking feet water like beer. Just kidding. Anyway, let's get into our horrible, horrible case today.
Yep, let's do it.
Let's just get on with it. So Richard Trenton Chase was born May 23rd, 1950 in Sacramento, California. As a child, he was subjected to psychological and physical abuse by his parents. His father was a strict disciplinarian, and his parents were known to fight over financial problems that they were having. His mom also had mental health issues and saw multiple psychiatrists at the same time. Which, I wonder if you have multiple psychiatrists, if you're going to have just multiple people assigning you drugs, you know? Because psychiatrists are typically the people who give you your medicine. Anyway, and he also had a sister that was 4 years younger than him. By the age of 10, he was displaying behaviors of the McDonald triad, or the triad of sociopathy. He would set fires, was a persistent bedwetter, and abused animals, especially cats. In 1963, when he was 13 years old, his parents' financial troubles were so bad that they lost their house. During his adolescence, he started to use drugs, which is also very common for our serial killers here. In his sophomore year of high school, he was arrested for possession of marijuana. He went to juvenile court for this, and he was ordered to get a job on the weekends, which was most likely done to just try and keep him out of trouble.
Honestly.
And by the time that he was 18, Richard was drinking and using drugs every day, specifically marijuana and LSD, which I find interesting because that's the same thing that Richard Ramirez was doing.
It is.
Which I don't think marijuana makes you a serial killer. I don't think the LSD makes you a serial killer either, but I think you're taking an already broken, in some capacity, brain and then adding LSD to it, and it's, like, not helping in any way.
Yeah, I think putting, like, mind-altering drugs on someone who has mental illnesses isn't smart.
Unless you're, like, doing it in the ways that a doctor is telling you. Because people, like, treat depression and things now with, like, microdosing of mushrooms and LSD, but it's, like, it's done in a very specific way. It's not just like taking a bunch of tabs with your friends, you know, which is what these guys were doing. And despite all of these behaviors, he did okay in high school. He got mainly C's and D's. So good, not great. And graduated in 1968. While he was in high school, he had relationships with women, but they never lasted very long as he struggled with impotence and sexual problems would get in the way of these relationships. He went to go see a psychiatrist for his sexual problems at some point, and here he learned that the root cause of his impotence was from repressed anger. And after high school, he enrolled in American River College, which is a community college in Sacramento. And he had a C average in college, but continued using drugs throughout.
And he dropped out. I forgot to put that in.
Okay.
All of this drug use eventually made him become paranoid, and he developed hypochondria. He believed that his cranial bones in his head had separated and were moving around, so he shaved his head in order to be able to watch it. He would also hold oranges up to his head, believing that his body would absorb the vitamin C. He would complain that his heart would occasionally stop beating, or a big one was that someone stole his pulmonary artery. He also believed that his blood was turning into powder and that his stomach was backwards. And one time he even walked into an emergency room demanding to know who took his pulmonary artery. And since doctors didn't take him seriously, as a way to treat himself, he would go out into the woods, capture small animals, kill them, and drink their blood. This apparently, according to him, cured his impotence problems along with his heart problems.
Mm-hmm. Which I would just like to say that in middle school, I also kept telling my parents that my heart felt like it was skipping beats and like palpitating, you know, and my parents like took me to the doctor. We did a whole day where I wore a chest thing, like monitoring my heart, blah, blah, blah.
I remember in high school you did that.
It was fucking anxiety. Like, I didn't know what being anxious was supposed to feel like, and went through all of these medical procedures for all of my doctors to be like, there's nothing wrong with you. And me now as a 25-year-old being like, oh, you were anxious. Yep. All the times you said your heart skipped a beat was anxiety. So maybe Richard was feeling these feelings as well, you know, with like his, because there seems to me to be some type of mental illness in here in some capacity.
Definitely. So Richard was still living with his parents, and he moved out as soon as possible, as soon as he graduated high school. And he did this because he believed that his mother was poisoning him. So he moved into an apartment with some friends, but things didn't go well with these roommates, as he would constantly walk around the house naked, even if company was over. And his drinking and drug use was worse than ever. He was constantly under the influence of some sort of substance.
Don't be a bad roommate.
Right? And one time he even nailed his closet door shut, thinking that people were invading his space and going through his stuff. So these roommates demanded that Richard move out. When he refused, they all moved out instead, and Richard had the apartment to himself. Since he was alone in the apartment, Richard started bringing the animals that he would capture, such as birds and rabbits, back home. He would disembowel them, drink their blood, sometimes eat them raw, and he would even put their organs into a blender with Coca-Cola and blend it up and drink the mixture. And he also believed that he was doing this to help his heart from shrinking, which is another one of the problems he thought that he had.
Right. Richard could not afford to be in this apartment alone for long, obviously, so he moved back home. But it seemed as though his parents didn't want him to be at home, as his father found him a new apartment to rent shortly after.
Yeah, they knew he was some sort of fucked up.
The next year, in 1972, Richard's parents separated and eventually divorced. In 1973... Richard attended a party at a friend's house. While at this party, he sexually assaulted a woman by fondling her. He was kicked out of the party after this, but came back later on, and he got the cops called on him by refusing to leave. When he was being escorted out, a .22 caliber pistol falls out of his waistband, and he was taken to jail. But his father bailed him out, so... Richard was then sent to a mental institution in 1973 for a bit when he was around 23 years old, but not much is known about this stay, and some sources even say that he escaped from this place. In 1976, he was hospitalized after injecting rabbit's blood into his veins, resulting in blood poisoning.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, that's truly, truly disgusting. After this, he was involuntarily placed into a mental institution called Beverly Manor. During this stay, the workers at the institution were actually afraid of Richard and referred to him as Dracula because of his fascination with blood. multiple times he would be found with blood on his face, which he would then claim just came from shaving. On two separate occasions, he reached through the bars of the windows and caught a bird that was sitting on the windowsill. He bit off their heads and drank their blood in order to get his blood fix. He would also extract blood from therapy dogs that would visit with stolen syringes, which is just...
terrible.
What? Why, sir? Please stop. And during his time, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and with having somatic delusions, which all of that checks out.
Mm-hmm.
He was weaned off of the illegal drugs and medicated with a range of antipsychotic drugs. So it feels like things are looking up for Richard.
Yeah, because later in that same year, his doctors believed that he was showing improvements and was no longer a threat to society, so they released him into his mother's care. And his mother thought, since he was released, that he was just cured and no longer needed to be on his antipsychotic medications, so she weaned him off of them and moved him into his own apartment.
Which... I know she didn't mean to, but that was a horrible decision. Mm-hmm.
So, being on his own again, he continued his massacre of small animals. He started stealing neighborhood pets, including cats and dogs, so he's kind of growing from, like, birds and rabbits.
Yeah.
And one time, he even called a family whose dog was missing to tell them what he did to their beloved pet.
Super fucked up, Richard.
Mm-hmm. During this time, he also started buying guns and practiced using them. And he also stopped, like, taking care of himself. He wouldn't shower, didn't brush his teeth, or really even eat daily. So he was just looking really rough.
Yeah.
One time, he went to visit his mother, and while he was there, she heard a loud noise and discovered Richard holding a dead cat. He pushed the cat's body into her face and then threw the animal to the ground, ripped it open with his bare hands, and smeared its blood all over his face and neck. His mother apparently didn't do anything about this and didn't report the incident to his doctors or anything like that. The next year, in August of 1977, Richard made a 180-mile road trip to an Indian reservation near Pyramid Lake in Nevada. Residents of the reservation saw a man walking around aimlessly, covered in blood-stained clothes, and they called the county sheriff's office. When the police arrived, they searched his truck, finding guns, blood-stained clothes, and a bucket full of blood. They discovered that the blood in the bucket belonged to a cow. And when they found Richard, he was walking around naked and again covered in blood. Richard explained that the blood that was on his clothes was from hunting, but the blood that was on his body was his own blood that had just seeped out of him. No charges were filed, and Richard just had to pay a fine for illegal hunting.
Mm-hmm.
During this time, Richard also developed a strong fascination with the Hillside Strangler, who was operating pretty close to Richard's area around this time, and he would avidly read all of the news coverage from these crimes. In early December of 1977, Richard set fire to his neighbor's garage in order to try and get them to move away because the music that they played annoyed him.
Yeah, he's just like slowly but surely escalating all of his behavior.
Exactly.
On December 29th, 1977, Richard killed a person for the first time in a drive-by shooting. The victim was a 51-year-old man named Ambrose Griffin. He was an engineer and a father of two sons. He and his wife had just returned from going grocery shopping, and he was helping bring in the grocery bags when he was shot twice with a .22 caliber gun. His wife heard popping noises, but didn't think anything of it. And when she discovered her husband on the ground outside, she thought that he had had a heart attack. It was when they got to the emergency room when they discovered that he had actually been shot. One of Ambrose's sons had seen a man walking around their neighborhood carrying a rifle, so he tailed the man and called the police. But it turned out that this was not the suspect, as the only gun on him was not a .22, just a casual man carrying a rifle instead.
Right.
On that same afternoon, a 12-year-old boy reported that a man with brown hair in his 20s had tried to shoot him as he rode his bike. He said that the man was driving a brown Pontiac Trans Am, and this boy was put under hypnosis, where he recalled a license plate number, but unfortunately, this led nowhere. 2 days earlier, on December 27th, a woman called police after a bullet had been shot into her home. She only lived a few blocks away from the Ambrose Griffin's house. Police discovered a .22 caliber slug in her kitchen, and after the shooting at the Griffin household, they compared the bullets and discovered that they had all been fired from the same gun. After this, all of the leads from the Griffin shooting dried up.
On January 11th, 1978, so just a couple weeks later, one of Richard's neighbors from his apartment complex had kind of a weird encounter with him. The neighbor, Don Larson, was approached by Richard and he asked her for a cigarette. But after giving him one, he refused to let her leave until she gave him the whole pack. She also reported that she saw Richard carry three small animals into his apartment, even though there were no animals allowed there. However, she never saw these animals again. And she didn't really think much of it and just thought that he was like an odd, lonely man. A few weeks after this, on January 23rd, 1978, a woman named Jean Layton saw a man approach her house while she was outside on her patio. She watched the man, later identified as Richard, try to open her door, which was locked. He then tried all of her windows, which were also locked. So he just goes back to the door where she met him face to face. He didn't say a word, just stared at her for a minute, then turned, lit a cigarette, and walked away. On that same day, just down the street, Robert and Barbara Edwards had just arrived home, again from grocery shopping like the first victim. When they went to bring in the groceries, they heard a noise coming from inside the house. The person inside the house had gotten spooked and escaped through a back window. Edward did chase this man down, but lost him when the man, who was Richard, jumped the fence. When the police were called, the house had been ransacked and valuables were taken. However, they discovered in their infant child's room that the intruder had urinated in a drawer of child's clothing and had defecated on the child's bed. So this was just like a very weird thing that he had, I guess, against children.
Yeah.
After Richard was caught, FBI agent Robert Ressler interviewed him and asked him how he picked his victims. And Richard told him that he would walk around just trying random doors to see if they were unlocked. If the doors were locked, he knew that he wasn't welcome there. And if they were unlocked, then he walked right in.
Yeah, that is horrifying, but always also lock your doors. A reason to lock your doors. After escaping from the house of Robert and Barbara Edwards, Richard was not done with trying to break into homes that day. He made his way to the house at 2360 Tioga Way, which belonged to David and Teresa Wallen. David was at work this day, and 22-year-old Teresa, who was 3 months pregnant at the time, was alone home with her German Shepherd. Richard came up to the door and opened it, and at the same time that he was doing this, Teresa was actually also at the door to take out the trash. Shocked, Teresa dropped the garbage bag as Richard raised his .22 caliber pistol, shooting her twice. The first bullet went into her hand and out through her elbow, nicking her neck. The second bullet hit her at the top of her skull. She fell to the ground, and Richard fired one last shot at her into her temple, killing her. Richard then dragged her body into the bedroom, leaving a trail of blood on the ground. He then went into the kitchen, grabbed a knife, and also grabbed an empty yogurt container from the trash bag that Teresa had dropped. And warning, the next portion is going to be very graphic, so just skip ahead a little bit if you would like to. Richard then used the knife to mutilate the body. He stabbed her repeatedly in the lung, diaphragm, and left breast, cutting off her nipple. He also sliced open her torso, pulling out her spleen and intestines. Her kidneys were cut out of her body and then placed back inside of it. He then raped the corpse and also used the empty yogurt container to collect her blood and drink it. As a final act of desecration, he went into the backyard, collected some dog feces, and stuffed it into her mouth. So he just had, like, a complete disregard for humans in general.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, there was nothing he wouldn't do.
Yeah. Teresa's husband, David, came home from work at around 6 p.m. that night, finding the house dark. He noticed the bag of trash on the ground and a stain on the ground, but he thought it was oil. He followed the stain to his bedroom, where he found his wife's body. She was just inside the bedroom door with her sweater pulled up to reveal her breasts and her pants and underwear pulled down around her ankles. There were rings of blood surrounding the body, indicating that there had been a bucket placed on the ground. The bathroom was also covered in blood, and it was later determined that in the bathroom, Richard had smeared Teresa's blood all over his face and neck and licked it off his fingers. David then ran next door to a neighbor's house to call the police. The first officer that was on scene later admitted that he was so horrified by what he saw that he had nightmares for months afterwards. After this gruesome crime, FBI agent Robert Ressler, who is known for coining the term serial killer, was called in to create a profile of this killer. His profile said that it would likely be a white male aged 25 to 27 who will be thin, unkempt, and spend most of his time at home where there will be evidence of the crime. The suspect will have a history of mental illness and drug use, probably suffering from one or more types of paranoid psychosis. He will be unemployed with no prior military record and may be a high school or college dropout. He said that this is a disorganized killer who does not plan out his murders beforehand and does not know the difference between right and wrong. Sacramento police agreed with Bressler in saying that if this man is not caught, he will strike again.
So, 2 days after this murder, Richard bought two puppies from a family. The family said that this man was unkempt with stringy hair, and that he had no concern on whether the puppies were male or female. Later that day, the family found the deceased and severely mutilated body of one of the puppies that they had sold Richard in their front lawn. So it's like very... I'm kind of confused about why someone wouldn't report this.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows? Maybe they did and they didn't know his name or something. But yeah, who knows?
He could have used a false name when going to pick up the puppy. It's the 70s. They didn't they couldn't go check his Facebook to make sure it was the right person, you know?
That's true. And I feel like, I don't actually know this, but I feel like back then they probably didn't have as strict of animal abuse laws as they do now.
Maybe, I'm not sure.
On the morning of January 27th, just 16 days after the murder of Teresa Wallen, Richard struck again at the residence of 38-year-old Evelyn Mirith, who is only 1 mile away from the Wallen residence. Evelyn Mirith was at home with her 6-year-old son, Jason. She was also babysitting her 22-month-old nephew, David Ferreira. Her friend, 51-year-old Dan Meredith had also just stopped by to visit. The 6-year-old Jason had actually had plans to hang out with a neighbor that morning, and when he never arrived, the little girl came over to see where he was. She returned home telling her parents that she saw someone moving around in the home, but no one came to the door when she locked. And in reality, this was Richard inside the home, and her knocks actually scared him off, but not before he was able to inflict a lot of damage. After a while, the neighbors started getting worried, and one finally went to the house to check on the family and walked inside. This neighbor saw the body of the friend, Dan Meredith, dead on the floor in the hallway, so they left and called the police. When the police arrived, they first saw Dan's body as well, laying in a pool of blood with a gunshot wound to the head. They then went into the bathroom, which is why they went, and the tub was also filled with red tainted water. Evelyn's body was found next, and again, this is another very graphic part. She was naked and believed to have been taking a bath when the killer came in. Her body was laying on the bed in her room with her legs wide open. She had a gunshot wound to the head, along with a slice to her abdomen where her intestines were pulled out. 2 carving knives laid nearby her body, which were covered in blood. She had also been sodomized during the autopsy. It was discovered that there was a mass amount of semen inside of her rectum, meaning that he had raped her multiple times. She also had been stabbed through the anus and into her uterus at least 6 times. Several slices were made across her neck, and he had also tried to cut out her eye. Several of her internal organs had also been stabbed as well. Again, there were bloody circles on the carpet, indicating that some sort of bucket was used to collect blood. On the other side of the bed, the body of Evelyn's 6-year-old son, Jason, was found. He had been shot in the head 2 times from close range. Karen Ferreira, David's mother, came onto the scene looking for her baby son. No one had seen the baby, but a crib was discovered that had a bullet hole through the pillow, and this pillow was also covered in blood. And it was believed that the baby had been taken. It was later found out that while Richard was still in the home, after shooting the infant, he mutilated the body in the bathroom. When the knock on the door startled Richard, he took the baby's body with him back to his apartment. And at the apartment, he continued to mutilate the toddler's body and cannibalized it, essentially.
The killer had left behind bloody footprints that were similar to footprints found at the Wallen household. He had also left perfect handprints behind at the scene. An 11-year-old reported seeing a man in his 20s walking around outside of the victim's house at around 11 a.m. Dan Meredith's red station wagon was missing from the front of the house, where neighbors had seen it parked earlier that day. The station wagon was found shortly after, abandoned in a parking lot with the door open and the keys still in the ignition. What police didn't know is that the car was dumped only around 100 yards from the apartment complex where Richard Chase lived. The FBI investigation started immediately. After finding the abandoned station wagon, Robert Ressler and his team of 65 officers started searching the area, believing that the killer would still be nearby. They thought this because the killer had to have walked to the crime scene in order to steal the car to get away. They used the profile they came up with to question people around the scene. Many people said that they saw a white man driving a red station wagon, but no one was able to give a super detailed description. But then, one woman came forward, Nancy Holden. On the day of the Wallen murder, Nancy was out shopping when she was approached by a strange man. This man was thin, looked disheveled, and was wearing big, dirty clothes with large dark circles around his eyes. The man walked up to her and said, "Were you on the motorcycle when Kurt was killed?" And Nancy was in shock, as 10 years earlier in high school, she had dated a boy named Kurt who had died in a motorcycle accident. She felt as though this man looked familiar, but couldn't place him, so she asked who he was. He replied, "Rick Chase." She was dumbfounded, as this man did not look anything like the clean-cut Rick Chase. Holy shit. She talked with him for a few minutes, and he followed her out into the parking lot, insistent on getting a ride from her. She managed to get in her car and lock the doors before he got in, and she drove off as he was making her feel very uncomfortable. When she talked to the police and was given a description of the man they were looking for, including the fact that the killer was wearing an orange ski parka, and Richard had been wearing a jacket exactly like that on the day that she met him, Nancy gave police Richard's name.
The police also got another clue that linked Richard. A .22 caliber semi-automatic handgun had been purchased by a Richard Chase in December of 1977, the same month that Ambrose Griffin was killed. Police were also able to determine that Richard bought more ammo on January 10th. After this information was discovered, the FBI did a background check on Richard Chase and discovered that he had a history of mental illness, a series of small charges, including weapons charges and drug busts, as well as that weird incidents that happened in Nevada. They found his address for his apartment complex on Watt Avenue and went to check it out one day after the murder. Upon arriving at the apartment, the police continuously knocked on the door, but Richard wouldn't answer. They eventually pretended like they were leaving, but instead hid, waiting for Richard to emerge. When he did, he had a box under his arm and was heading to his car. This is when the police ambushed him. There was a struggle between Richard and the police, but he was eventually apprehended. And he was wearing the same dirty orange parka as before, and he was also wearing blood-stained shoes. His .22 caliber gun was on him. Also had bloodstains on it. And the police also found Dan Meredith's wallet in his back pocket, along with a pair of latex gloves. And the box that he was carrying around contained bloodstained papers and rags.
The police then took Richard down to the police station while they searched his apartment. At the station, he admitted to killing several dogs and small animals, but would not talk about the murders. They took his clothes to process the bloodstains on them and also took hair samples. When they tried to take a blood sample, Richard freaked out, afraid of losing his blood, and had to be restrained. Back at the apartment, police entered to find a filthy home that had a putrid smell to it. Almost everything was covered in blood, including the food and dishes. In the kitchen, they found pieces of bone and containers filled with organs. There was even a container with pieces of brain in the refrigerator. They also found the blender that Richard used to blend up his concoctions, and it was also blood-stained and smelled of rot. Three pet collars were also found, but no pets were at the premises, and newspapers were spread out on the table, with circles pointing out dogs that were being sold, and the police also found a calendar which had the word "today" written on the dates of the Wallen murder and the Triple murder. The word "today" was also written on 44 more future dates in the calendar.
So, like, he was planning on doing these murders again 44 more times in just that year.
Yeah, which is crazy. There was no sign of the missing baby, though. Police continued searching for it, even using bloodhounds. They also tried to search Richard's mother's house for any evidence, but she was uncooperative. She insisted that even though the police had found all of the stuff at his apartment, that it didn't prove that he murdered anyone. So she's just in denial.
100%.
Eventually, on March 24th, 2 months after the murders, the body of the boy was found. A church janitor came across a box in the church parking lot containing the remains of a baby and called the police. The police immediately recognized the clothing on the boy as belonging to baby David. The baby had been decapitated and his head was placed under the body inside the box. The head had a bullet-sized hole in it, and there were also several stab wounds to the torso of the body, and some of his ribs had been broken.
Before the trial took place, a change of venue was requested, as the case had so much notoriety to it, and the trial was moved 120 miles south to Santa Clara County. The trial started on January 2nd, 1979, and lasted 4 months, and Richard was being charged with 6 counts of first-degree murder. Richard pled not guilty by reason of insanity, but the prosecution tried to prove that he was not insane, and they were seeking the death penalty. The prosecution had over 250 pieces of evidence against Richard, the most crucial being his gun and the fact that he had Dan Meredith's wallet on him when he was arrested. Over 100 witnesses took the stand in the trial, the first being David Wallen, Teresa's husband, who described the scene he walked into when discovering his wife's body. After all of the witnesses took the stand, Richard decided to take the stand himself in his own defense. He looked terrible. His eyes were sunken in, and he had lost around 40 pounds since he had been arrested and weighed only 107 pounds. And they said he was like 5'7".
Yeah.
While on the stand, he talked about his bad childhood, and he also recalled drinking Teresa Wallen's blood. He said that he could not recall much from the last set of murders except for killing the baby. He thought that his problems stemmed from his sexual issues as a teenager, and he also said that he was sorry for the killings. On May 8th, after 6 hours of deliberation, a jury found Richard to be sane and guilty of all 6 counts of first-degree murder. It took them another 4 hours to determine a sentence, and they decided that Richard Chase was to receive the death penalty and to die in the gas chamber at San Quentin Penitentiary.
I don't think I agree with the basis that he was sane in any capacity, but...
Me either, and neither does our friend here.
Yeah. After he was sentenced, Robert Ressler interviewed Richard many times and wrote about him in his book, Whoever Fights Monsters. Ressler disagreed with the ruling, thinking that Richard should have been found insane and should spend the rest of his life in a mental hospital. The first time Ressler met with him, Richard's appearance shocked him. He thought that Richard looked ghoulish, but was most struck by his eyes, saying, "I'll never forget them. They were like those of the shark in the movie Jaws. No pupils, just black spots. These were evil eyes that stayed with me long after the interview. I almost got the impression that he couldn't really see me, that he was seeing through me, just staring." Richard also never showed any signs of aggression towards the FBI agent who came to interview him, which is interesting. And he told Ressler that he had killed in order to preserve his own life and talked about soap dish poisoning. When Ressler asked him what that was, he said that everyone has a soap dish. If you pick up the soap and it's dry underneath, you are fine. But if it is wet and gooey underneath, you have been poisoned, and this poison turns your blood into powder, depleting your energy and making your body waste away.
Well, I've been poisoned my whole life.
He also talked about being Jewish, which he was not, and that the Nazis persecuted him because he had a Star of David on his head, which he also did not have. And he claimed that the Nazis were connected to the UFOs that followed him around. He believed that he was being poisoned by the prison food and asked Ressler to check it for poison.
Yeah, there was like one point where he just pulled out a handful of mac and cheese from his pocket and was like, I need you to test this.
Yeah, he definitely could have benefited from being in a mental hospital.
100%. Richard also talked to many psychiatrists, and he was interviewed by at least 12. And he told one that the first killing happened after his mother refused to let him visit for Christmas, so he just went in his car and started firing shots off. All of these psychiatrists that he talked to said that he had delusions and antisocial personality disorder, along with some other things. But none of them actually diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia, which is what he had been diagnosed with years prior. During his time in prison, he was taken to a mental hospital, but returned to the prison after a short period of time. But as we believe, he should have stayed there.
Yeah.
Many of the other inmates at San Quentin taunted Richard and urged him to kill himself. Most of them avoided him at all costs after learning about the severity of his crimes. On December 26th, so the day after Christmas, in 1980, the guard making rounds checked in on Richard, who was laying down in his bunk on his back and reportedly breathing normally. On his next round, at 11:05 p.m., the guard looked in on his cell again. This time, Richard was on his stomach, with his legs hanging off the bunk and both feet on the floor. His arms were extended up towards the pillow. After the guard called out to Richard and he didn't respond, this guard went into the cell and discovered that Richard was dead. The coroner, K.P. Holmes, was called, and upon searching the cell, they discovered a suicide note talking about taking pills. It turns out that Richard was on medication for depression and hallucinations, which came to him in the form of 3 pills every day. Richard had been hoarding the pills over several weeks and took them all at once in order to kill himself. The autopsy determined this, and his cause of death was toxic ingestion, and they also examined his heart. And despite his lifelong concerns about it stopping and being turned into powder, his heart was in perfect working order. He died the day before the 3rd anniversary of the first killing, and he was 30 years old when he died. Like, in 2 months, he killed 6 people so gruesomely.
Yeah, and just, like, ruined the lives of so many people. Yeah. Thanks, Malachi. That was super fucked up.
Right?
Just kidding. It was
like,
good.
Honestly, I think I had heard of it before, but I never, like, really looked into it. And, yeah, this is the most fucked up one we've done, I think.
Yeah, there's a reason why we haven't done this case. Just like the toy box killer and things like that.
It'll come one day.
They're just... pretty gross. But we hope that you guys enjoyed it nonetheless, despite the graphic nature. And hope that you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts if you did like it.
Please check us out on our social medias. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Crime Binge or Crime Binge Podcast. And we also have the website, which is crimebinge.com, where you can leave a submission on what story you want us to tell, just like Malachi did, or email us at crimebinge@gmail.com.
Yeah. And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.